respect the reality that they're Christians. Insist on a civil conversation that embodies respect and integrity. I was much enriched in many ways by my friendship with Dr. Robertson, and I sincerely hope that this forum, to which he devoted so many hours, can also enrich our collective intellectual and spiritual lives.
Thank you.
So this is where I would normally tease you by giving you an announcement on our next two or three programs and the good speakers we're going to bring in. But we haven't planned past today. We're not jumping into the lake. We're taking our toes and just very carefully checking the waters. The forum board has been doing a lot of soul searching. Because of COVID, the world has moved online. And the world has changed. Other Sabbath school classes have jumped in, Sabbath school classes and other organizations, and have invited very good speakers on very good topics. These are speakers and topics that we would have invited and we would have asked speakers to talk about. So we're trying to decide what our role is and where we go from here. Should the forum continue to host live programs? How many? Should we still do it every month during the school year, or should we just do it quarterly? Should we do a mix of hybrid programs or try to do Zoom programs? This is where you come in. If you have ideas on what we should do, please come and talk to us and let us know. We're making plans. Stay in touch with us. If you're not on our email list, there's a clipboard at the back. You put your name on there, and we will let you know what direction we're going, whether we're still bringing in speakers, whether we're moving to Zoom. So if you want to stay in touch with us, please make sure that we have your email address and phone number. We are always grateful for your financial report, along with the clipboard at the back. I have some envelopes for you. Please feel free to put a check in there and mail it to us. Before we get going, I also want to thank those who keep working on making forum work. I need to mention the names of Kathy Cadell, Jim Hayward, Jim Harris, John Ney, Bruce Zimmerman, and of course, Art Robertson, who was involved in the planning of this program. Our speaker today has agreed to do a Q&A session after the panel presentation, so keep your questions in mind. I'm delighted now to ask our own university president, Dr. Luxton, who will welcome and introduce our speaker.
Thank you very much, and first of all, welcome. We are delighted to have you back here in person, and whatever decisions you make about whether you're going to go totally online or use our facilities, we're always delighted to host you and host the conversations that come from this very thoughtful gathering of people. I think it was David that mentioned things had changed as you came in. And so I do just want to give a shout out to that. I hope you noticed the beautiful lobby out there. And I want to give credit for that. That was Advent Health that gave us a donation to really change the format and the look of this building. And it really has made a significant change in the sense of community as you come into this building. So I just wanted to mention that. It's my pleasure to introduce our speaker today. I don't know that I really need to introduce him. I think everyone here knows Dr. Andreessen probably as well as I do. We have some things in common. We both have European roots, and we both have been our presidents of a university. But I think more than that, the conversation today is about lifelong education, reflections, looking from that perspective. And that really is Dr. Andreessen's life. If you look at the topic, university, church, belief, Dr. Andreessen comes with a strong theological background. He has been in his past a teacher, but has remained always very, very thoughtful on the theological stage. very engaged in that intersection between what happens in a university and the church. And so I know from the conversations that we have had over many years that what he's speaking about today has been his passion. It's not just a conversation he's having with you today. These are ideas that he has been thinking about and mulling over for many, many years. And that's why I know that what he will bring to you today will be extremely rewarding. Dr. Andreasen has managed to walk that difficult pathway sometimes between, you know, we talk about the church and education and sometimes the potential conflict that might exist between those. And he has lived in the complexity of that tension that exists in those two worlds. And I think will always continue to exist because university by its very nature tends to push the edges some. And the church is very keen to maintain that core. So when those two things come together, you have some interesting conversations. So I know he is talking about a lived experience when he speaks to us today, too. So Dr. Andreasen, Nils Erik, we're delighted to have you here.
So a few months after I retired, I bumped into an acquaintance of mine, kind of a sure relative through marriage, and he walked straight up to me at the main aisle of the church where we were, and he said, "So where's the book?" "Oh, what book is that?" "Well," he said, "you're retired, you can say whatever you want. You're supposed to write down what you have on your heart. You know where all the corpses are buried and where the skeletons are kept in the closet, so lay it out in a book like the other ones did." I said, "I'm sorry, there is no book." So my friend David, I don't know, you just press them all until you find the right one. So David said, "Supposing we don't record you, would you give us the real juicy stories?" And I said, "So David, my off the record and my on record comments generally are the same. That's just the way I do stuff." And that they may make everything boring, I don't know. But I've also found, incidentally, that working in administration, it is really smart to say the same thing in the office as you say outside the office. And so I tried to practice that on the record, off the record, in the office, out of the office. It may make it a little boring and less juicy, but it just seems to, things seem to work better that way. So you will get the off-record, on-record, whatever you call it, reflection, and I don't have anything profound to say, just some thoughts on the matter. How are we doing? I don't have a PowerPoint, just a few outline points, so it's easier to follow as we go along. Well, let me tell you how I plan to do it while Kathy's figuring it out. Oh, here we go. It looks like something I did. Oh, here we go, back. There you go, that's good. Okay, I'll see if I can figure it out. I used to have Dalry, she did that stuff for me, and now I have to do it myself. And my wife is no help, so she's not a techie. Anyway, I have three key thoughts or points that I would like to expound upon a bit, and here they are by way of introduction. Something about American higher education. I just want to make a comment about that because I think it's important, and I think there's a connection between that and our own Adventist education that we sometimes overlook. I want to say something about the place of the Christian university and the church structurally and organizationally, because I think we've not always done that the best way. And thirdly, university education and church teaching. These are the topics I will cover. And in a minute, I'll go to the next screen and it just gives an outline of my comments. And you can sort of follow along a little bit. But here we go. A friend of mine recently suggested that the greatest gift from America to the world in our time is not the successful US intervention in World War II, nor the mass-produced automobile, nor jazz music, but the development of the American research university during the 20th century. So much progress in science, technology, communication, medicine, education, psychology, philanthropy, and so on came out of the university. It has been a tremendous force for good and for the betterment of human life. And I know universities sometimes do some real funny things, tomfoolery and so on, but leaving that aside, the core activity of the American university has been tremendous. And whenever you go to the medical office or the doctor and they want to poke you, thank the university for the new technology. Invented in the university, developed in the engineering department, medical engineering, and we are the beneficiaries of that. I just want to say that because I think it's important, and I think the 118 Adventist universities around the world somehow should see themselves in light of that. We are, of course, much smaller, and we don't have the same horsepower, but in our own way, to scale, our Adventist universities have contributed that way, and we often overlook it. That's too bad, I think. So that was my first point. Now the second one you see up here has something to do with a Christian university, and I think that has a very important role to play. It's like a type of university. It's not entirely different from the big university, research university, but it's certainly related to it, focusing upon spiritual values, ethical principles, and service, developing people who aspire to decency, truthfulness, social responsibility, faith, and hope throughout the curriculum and the activities of the Christian university. And we need to remember that too, because we easily get driven into some other topics about church activities, which are best done in the church and not in the university. So the Christian university is really super important. They may be small, but the influence is much larger than we think. And we should nurture that and promote that. And Andrews, of course, is what I know best. I worked at Loma Linda too, and Walla Walla. But so that's my second point. The Christian university, like Andrews, serves the world of education with its own unique distinctive values. Not a subset of a church, but just Christian university as university. That was the second point. And I'll elaborate on that later on. The third one has to do with, that's a little more complicated. It has to do with what the church cares about and what the university cares about. And my point here is that church and university shares so many passions for the greater welfare of and service to all people of the world that they are right, church and university, they are right in making common cause, in collaboration, in sharing intellectual properties, and listening carefully to each other. It should be so, I believe. And that's what I spent my life on, so I guess I believe in it. In this, we have some success and we have lots of failures too. This common cause between church and Christian university should be cherished, not deplored, for the sake of the human race. That would be my third point. The church and university must find each other again in an intellectual embrace if Christianity is to retain whatever is left of its influence for good in the world today. And that influence is diminishing. It doesn't matter where you look, and the church comes up on the headlines in the newspaper, some kind of muckety-muck. You know, now it was Canada and the schools up there, and then it's pedophilia, and then the Baptists just had a big report about their misbehavior. And so the church is at risk as much as the university, but the university can help it to sharpen its thinking a little bit. So that would be my third point. Now I'll come back to the first. Oops, I'm getting it. What in the world? Ah, So I'll speak a little bit about Andrews, because that's the first Adventist university. And I want to say why I think it has an important role to play. And it may not, I guess you agree with it. I don't know. We'll see. A brave beginning, an uncertain future, the initiatives of Presidents Butler and Figuer. They were not university presidents. They were General Conference presidents, both of them. And it's astonishing what they did. We are so used to think that they don't care about our school. They cared a bunch and did a lot. So it was a brave undertaking. When our first college, Battle Creek, now Andrews, was founded in 1874, the board chairman, not the college president, but the board chairman, Pastor Butler, bravely promised that the college would have, I don't know how he did it, a full complement of qualified faculty resources, and would bring within the reach of all qualified applicants first-class school privileges. That's what he wrote. I don't know if you remember that. That's what he called the educational opportunities, meaning that you could not do better in education anywhere else. Quote, "We mean business," he said. Quote, "How far above the low and sordid we may be lifted in pure intellectual enjoyment," end quote. That was a general conference president speaking as a board chairman. "How far above the low and sordid we may be lifted in pure intellectual enjoyment." It struck me. An advocate for liberal education could not say it much better today. Lift the whole population out of the muck of life. I do not actually think or know that Pastor Butler fully comprehended what he was promising to do so confidently that day, but I still believe in what he was saying, even if he didn't know what he was saying quite. And I'm putting it that way because a few years later, you know, the college closed and they had all sorts of difficulties, but he had already said it. And once you say it, it stays. In fact, if I should describe my own sense of this university during the 25 years I have been here, it would be that it never really stopped listening to the aspiration of its founding fathers and mothers. And may I remind you, by the way, that Pastor Butler was not the only church administrator who had such aspirations for Adventist education. Exactly 85 years later, 1959-60, another GC president, Pastor R.R. Figuer, also somewhat recklessly, insisted on establishing two universities in our church in 1 year, the same year. According to Adventist historian Gilbert Valentine, you know, his little book, his big book, thick book, Figuer had concluded that the church needed more people with graduate degrees to get its work done. That's why he did it. It was not because the faculty in these colleges were so anxious to have graduate programs. It's because he was anxious to have people in his church with graduate degrees, says Valentine. And so he proceeded forthwith to establish two universities against the advice of many. One prominent financial administrator in our church insisted in my hearing, when I was still a graduate student at Vanderbilt, that our church needed a university, let alone two, as much as a submarine needs a screen door. He just laughed at it. And I was a graduate student. I didn't have the courage to say, "Sir, are you sure you go against the General Conference president who wants two universities and you want a screen door for your submarine?" It was a strange experience. And by the way, both GC presidents, in their very basic, simple way, unwittingly perhaps, looked outside the church to get their inspiration. Butler looked at higher education in Michigan, and Figuer looked at graduate programs across the country. And he needed pastors with graduate degrees, he needed healthcare workers with graduate degrees, and all his students had to scrounge around in public universities, and he thought we ought to do better If we need it, we should provide it in our own schools. That was Figur. Well, the fact that they got their inspiration from outside the church certainly created some challenges in time, but first, some stepping stones for these two institutions, I mean, Butler's College and Figur's University, and this is just thought stuff I thought about, and you know it better than I do. But as far as I know, Battle Creek College, now Andrews, was the first of the Michigan independent church-related colleges that became a university. And the most recent to do that is Calvin. It just became a university. The other 14, that's about how many there were colleges in my day, most of them, one or two exceptions, except Andrews, Madonna. But the other ones have now since become universities. We were the first, which I think had something to do with these presidents and what they aspired for the institution. At one point during my tenure here, we had some 6,000 students on and off campus. More locally, a gentleman stopped me one time and said, by the way, I noticed that we in southwestern Michigan have acquired our very own university, and I drive by it on 31 every day on my way to work. Well, that sort of local recognition of Adventist universities occurs commonly in developing countries, because our universities are sometimes big and sometimes the better ones. That's an anecdote, but I was, Nigeria has a big Adventist university which began as a little one, and I was there once and they took me to meet the provost of a big public university. So we talked a bit and he said, I really appreciate your Adventist university in Nigeria, and I send my kids there. I said, so what's so good about it? And he said, it's very simple. Teachers teach, they don't strike. But in our university, they strike all the time, and the kids have to spend an extra year to finish their degree. I said, well, that's something. So the university has stayed committed to research, even though we are very small. And I just heard from Gary about the latest grant of $5 million from Lilly. It keeps coming, in spite of all the obstacles we have. And internationalism continues, and I think inclusivity is at work. Educators in Michigan began to take notice of the university that was pressed to live up to Butler's and Figur's promises. One Michigan college president, it's one of the few that are still at college now, once told me about coming to Andrews regularly to get help for his research and education. I said, well, good for you. And a senator, a US senator from Michigan, asked me if he would come and see for himself what the fuss is about. So I invited him to speak at graduation. And I said, see what? What is it you want to see? Well, he said, a tidy, well-mannered, beautiful campus, full of lively students, many speaking international English, reminding one of crossing Piccadilly Square at noon, as one consultant said. So, of course, there were challenges during these years, and some of them organizational and some educational. But that's in the nature of a university. Operating a university is never a walk in the park. And it's not right now, it's tough with COVID and what have you. But it seems to me that Adventist education, even with all that stuff going on, never stopped walking through the park. It never stopped. And when Gary said, we just got $5 million for research, well, so we're still walking. Even if you're struggling and need a walking stick sometimes to get along. Andrews University, along with all other Adventist universities, is still owned and operated by the Adventist Church. That's amazing, I think. I've always assumed, with some reason, that the church is secretly proud of its university. Now, when you walk across campus, you may not get that impression, but I got it, even fond of it. And I always wanted to reciprocate wherever I worked. And I would do that by saying to the church leaders and members that this church operates a good university in Michigan and ought to send their kids here, and further, that the university has a lively campus church, almost like a university chapel. It probably should be that. And students ought to attend it. So church and university should become gateways to each other. That we have not succeeded in doing. And I think we should have worked much harder on that. I mean, speaking to myself, of course. Now, you may think I become a Pollyanna about the Adventist University, and that I have skirted long-standing tensions between church and university, faith and learning. Yes, I know. I always like to look at the opportunities than to look at reality, because opportunities tend to lift and realities tend to depress you a little bit. Books have been written about this tension, and many forum groups have taken it up, and of course we'll talk about some of that too. But for now, just this. When Butler advocated persuasively for a new college, he wanted, he said, to lift, that was published in a review, by the way, for everyone to read. He wanted to lift church workers and members by calling them to discover a life of the mind and of service through education. I quote, a man, that's before gender, you know, it will be a person now. But he wrote, a man cannot be truly intelligent without education. General Conference President. And, quote, the mind is the noblest part of man. Now, he may not have acted upon that, but I would grab onto that. This is true. Figure, it seems, 85 years later, felt that the challenges, questions, opportunities facing the church 85 years later could not be addressed effectively without the kind of education provided in a university offering graduate degrees, and so he forthwith established two. Both these educational leaders, Butler's College and Figure's universities, 85 years apart, born in the church, inspired by higher education ideals in the world outside, inevitably would develop institutional personalities of their own and seek their own place to stand, not in opposition to the church, not above it, not beneath it, but just next to it. That was not understood, and I'm not sure it is still understood, so that's one of my burdens. It has been a bit worrying to some church leaders over the year, but that is what educational centers do. They look for a place to stand. Why did they not see that coming? Evidently, that was not anticipated by church leaders, but that's what happens when we establish universities. We establish an entity seeking a place to stand with and to contribute to. And we should be proud to do it. I recall, by the way, when I was a student here in the mid-60s, hearing Andrews faculty members who had come from Washington to Michigan in 1960 say that they now had moved away from the constant and direct oversight by the church, just across the street in Washington, to becoming more of a typical university, seeking to stand on its own, not away from the church, nor under the church, but with it. That's my formula. This sense of standing with the church touches upon two areas of university activities. One is governance and administration, and the other one is education objectives and teaching and learning. So in conclusion, that whole outline, going into the unknown and finding a place to stand, and that has to be a place suitable for a university, I think. And we have not figured that out. I'm beating myself over the head. Well, why did I not explain that more clearly when I had a chance? It's too late now. I mean, I think I tried and I maybe made a little headway, but to me, that's a big thing, because that's a more non-threatening. We're not trying to take over anything. We just want to be university, which is a wonderful thing to do, according to both the first General Conference President and the one in the middle. They both said it in so many words. So, that was that. Oh, so this will be the second point in my three outline. The first one was becoming a university and a place to stand, and that contribution to the world from America in the 20th century. And that needs to be taken up by the Adventist University, I think. The second one is relating to the church and what we have done and what I think remains to be done in that area. The church and university, governance, administration, and finance. And I think you probably know about all that better than I do, or at least as well. First, by giving birth to a new college and two universities, the two GC presidents, Pastor Butler and Pastor Figuer, set our church on a pathway of making education the proper preparation for church mission. Not all churches do that. But we've done it and then reneged on the commitment sometimes. And it really is true. I mean, you can take a sample of Adventist church workers around the world and ask them, where did you go to school? And they will answer, an Adventist college. That's the way to get on with it, to get into it, and find a position. And so these people said, if you take a master's degree, then we're going to provide that in our university. If you take a master's degree to do the job, I mean, that the church requires you to do. Not all churches in America have gone that way. Jehovah's Witnesses, for example, have not. And non-Christian religions in this country, I mean, you don't have Taoist universities in America, or Buddhist, I don't think too much of that either. It's these Christian churches with a heritage from Europe. And the reason for this is, I think, that in Europe, most universities were established by church authority through the king or the government or whatever. So the king of Denmark got permission from the Pope, the church, to establish the University of Copenhagen. And when Martin Luther came, the university said, now we're going to be approved by the Lutherans. But it was that way it worked. So Europe has a long history of that, and that's what we have too. So in time, these church-authorized institutions in this country and abroad established their own identity, not in opposition to their church, but neither under its close oversight. It appears that the founder of Adventist universities had not considered this question. And the question is, how do we relate to universities when they grow up? We like when they're children, we put some money in front of them and they do their work. But what when they grow up and get minds of their own and mature? It's not unlike a family with growing children. How are they growing to develop from toddlers to teens? And that question we should ask of universities. They're like families in a way. So two questions usually come up in raising children. Does the family have the resources, the money, to support them? And secondly, does the family have the time and ability to guide their development into mature, responsible adults? So, how do church universities develop from toddlers to teens? It's a simple way of putting it. And I don't remember ever having heard anybody in my circle of work asking this question. You can ask it in different ways, but how do we grow up? And what do we do when we become teens? Fight against the parents or get over it into our 20s and come home again as our own teenagers do after a while? That's a relationship, I think. So, a little bit by way of answer to that question, number two. As far back as I recall, the university has received annual operating and capital funding from the church. It pays for us. That's established by policy, and this has provided a steady stream of revenue to the university, in addition to the revenue from student tuition and fees. At times, even supplemented further with special, they call them specials, they're special financial appropriations, earmarked for scholarships, operations, or capital. this support from the church in my tenure of how many years has been so steadfast that we have compared it at times to a living endowment, equal perhaps to the annual ROI, return on investment, from a real endowment worth $250 million annually. It's amazing. I'm figuring 4% return on educational endowments. So for 100,000, you get 400 million, you get 4 million, right? And I don't know how much we get from the church, but when you round it all up, it will be a good bit more than that, I think. You will have the latest numbers here. This is unheard of in other Christian universities, as far as I know. So we have been blessed. So why do we feel so poor all the time? That's a trick question. I don't know the answer. But you know, I have expressed myself on that. And I think perhaps because the kind of education we offer and service we provide to our students are just very expensive. At any rate, this regular church financing of education has been seen over the years as a regular church function, something churches ought to do, and that has ramifications for the way we govern and manage our institutions, I think. At times, number three, yeah, at times I have wondered what would have happened if the church had not been so generous with us over the past many, many years. Would we have been forced to close down or to do what other private colleges had to do, namely attempt to build a stronger endowment or alternate sources of income? Church leadership generally has not been in favor of that. For years, the church actually discouraged building endowments for education, partly perhaps because it would take money away from other kinds of endowments that they were looking for. At times, I felt, perhaps wrongly, as though church leadership liked to provide funding in return for its direct influence over the university. In the same vein, I have wondered if the university at times felt its church loyalty was bought with financial support. So many years ago, before I came to Andrews, I shared with the board then and there that support from philanthropy had exceeded church support that year. It had been a very good year. Immediately, the church treasurer who was at the board expressed concern. He asked, will the church lose control? Will the university remain loyal if you get more money from philanthropy than from the church? We both talked and agreed that even to imagine church control and university loyalty were bought with financial support was a very bad idea. That's not how we become loyal. So I assured him that on my watch, we would stay with the church, no matter how much money we raised on the outside. It's a matter of mission, the right thing to do, a good place to be. The church support has been good to us, but it has put us behind in building endowments, and that has made the university somewhat vulnerable in a different sort of way as educational costs continue to escalate faster than church support. So moving on, historically speaking, therefore, the church has viewed the university as one of its departments. When I began this kind of management work, that's what I felt. For example, the youth department, for which it would provide staff and financial support. That would make the church and university almost inseparable if you're one department of the church. If you look back at Andrews University presidential roster, you'll see lots of cases where the educational department flipped into the university administration and back to education, viewing Andrews as a department of the church. The church would establish a board of governors, appoint a university president, You know, we have search committee now. They write me about it all the time. But my predecessor was appointed to be president of Andrews in a telephone call direct from Washington to the Middle East, where he was at the time, he told me. That's how it was. It's very recent that we're beginning to change that. So provide a university with a wage scale, a financial package, and a retirement plan. That became problematic as the university became a teen and the workforce grew into multiple specializations, academic and support, staff, various preparations, career paths, more like a small town workforce. And administration could not manage that, pretending it was a church department. Cannot do that. Butler's vision of a college as good as any and Vigour's dream of two universities set something in motion they did not foresee. And that was a university standing on its own feet. That began when university governance and administration changed somewhat from church style of organization and governance and moved closer towards the pattern of higher education in the country outside. And it happened. It happened with research activities, or what Butler called an intellectual center, an academic institution, research opportunities, and so on. That set in motion changes. They were inevitable. It was not bad people doing that. It was just a natural development of a university growing from toddler to teen. I'm not sure those of us in education have explained those changes clearly. I don't think I did. Or we have been too slow or done too little to implement those changes in a non-threatening way. Neither did we encourage, and we didn't encourage church leadership to consider such similar changes for the rapidly growing church itself. We could offer something, maybe. For of course, it too, the church too, had to deal with equally dramatic changes in its governance and management systems in light of its own economic, social, demographic, and other changes that we read about in the press all the time. So, being a department of the church, which we were for many years, just doesn't work. And it's not good or bad, it's just an operational question. So with reluctance by church leaders, lay membership has now for some time been on the board. Selection of administrators is referred to search committees, and there's one going on at Andrews right now, which is evidence of that. A university-specific wage scale and benefit package and a DC retirement plan has been introduced, and that's just for starters. It was introduced here in my time, and I remember the reaction. It was something to behold. But it was the right thing to do, and it was inevitable. I explained that to the board members. You know, we have on our staff the kind of people that are hired in Bering Sprints, just about all of them, except dog catcher. Everything, roads, security, roofs, and buildings, and night watchmen, and IT, and whatever they have in town, we have here. And we try to fit them into a pastor's workforce. It's not possible. So we have done all of that. Meanwhile, the teaching and research standards must conform more and more to the norms in higher education. And that's what Gary is dealing with. As learning outcomes must meet accreditation standards, especially in our many professional programs. These common practices of all higher education have given our institution a life of their own. And yet, in spite of all that, that looks like independence, but it really isn't. It's just survival in this environment. In spite of all of that, our universities remain church-owned and operated, even though most using mostly their own governance and management system, but under the umbrella of a church corporation. That's how we did it. It's an achievement, I think. By contrast, less than a year ago, the newspapers on the West Coast were filled with a story of the Lutheran Concordia University in Portland. The same size as ours, maybe a little bit bigger, under the Synod on the West Coast, the Lutheran Synod. And suddenly, somebody pulled a plug, and the university closed within 3 months. Just. Right. Now, you could point to many little things, little irritants that led to that, but the big picture in the newspapers were that. So it was empty. And what happens to empty colleges or universities? Well, I can tell you a sunshine story about this one, perhaps. One time, our son, who works in development at the University of Oregon, was walking through Portland during lunch, and he stumbled upon the Lutheran University. Everything had gone except the crosses. And he said, "That's too bad. I wonder if I can persuade the University of Oregon to buy it and make an off-site campus for the purpose of training teachers, counselors, social workers to help resolve the terrible problem of poor mental health of public school students in Oregon and in Portland." Could the Lutheran University be used to train all these people under the umbrella of the University of Oregon? So he went out and got a gift of $420 million from somebody, and the university bought the whole campus. They take the crosses. He said, "I can have the crosses. I can use them in our school. Take the cross." "Well, you can't do that in this country, can we? No crosses." But he said, "You can get all the religious stuff, and we will make it an extension of our school of education, and that's what we will do. We use this $420 million. And the state is happy, because these poor students in public schools are not graduating, they are not functioning because they have mental health issues because of COVID and family and all sorts of things, and the teachers are tearing their hair out. They need a whole new class of professionals to take care of that. And that's what will be provided at the Concordia Lutheran University in Portland. The church lost it. Somebody else will benefit. But we have a better way, I think, I hope. We have not done that sort of thing." So it's a little bit like if the Our Adventist University is like a young adult. She is growing up and moving out of the house, but not away from the family. And that is really what counts in Adventist education, not away from the family. Some have stated that a church which deals in religious truth and faith is incompatible with a university which deals in inquiry and evidence. I know that suggestion has knocked on our door as well. Do we have a shotgun marriage with our church or a happy union? Here's what I think. The Christian church is 2,000 years old, and the university is around 1,000. I mean the modern university. And the Adventists have 775 years of university church history of its own. One way to assess the value of anything is to imagine what life would be like without it. Would our church be where it is, and would our university be where it is without that partnership? I think not. On both counts. Each has blessed the other. And that's my thinking here. So to find a way where the two can stand, sort of on their own feet, not away, not outside the family, but at in an operational standing on its own to be efficient and effective so they can keep blessing each other. That's my formula on that point. And now I come to the last one, and that will not take too long. Nope, other way. Three. So that has to do with university education and church belief. How are we doing in that area? It's more personal, I think. Education and church belief. How do we hold it together during times of stress or change? And I'm not sure I have the answer to that. I just look at some things that were speaking to me. If you have ever visited a small Adventist church in rural Michigan, or Indiana, you will know there are differences between it and the campus church. I used to go out and preach. We went out, we drove for hours and hours, and finally we found this church, you know, like that, and a few people, and I would preach, and then we would have a church potluck. The differences between these two Adventist churches are caused by the presence of the university here. That's the only reason. Bayern Springs is a small town. It behaves like a small town in many ways, but it has the university, and that changes everything. Thank God. I have tales to tell about my interaction with the village, about what difference the university makes. Anyway, these differences are caused by the presence of the university and the extent to the way church members live, worship, witness, understand, and communicate their faith, all of it within the same Adventist family. So if that is true locally in Michigan, it will also be true in a worldwide Adventist church, wouldn't it? There will be differences emerging between regions, generations, and over the course of time because, among other things, the church operates a large educational program that enrolls presently 2.1 million students at all levels. That's one student for every 10 church members. I'm just saying it's a big system. It throws some weight around. You may think that's impressive, but in 1960, when Andrews and Loma Linda became universities, the Adventist educational system enrolled one student, not for every 10 church members, but for every four. That was when Figuer said two universities. It's interesting. It is impossible that such an educational program around the world will not impact the way we live and believe as Christians in various ways. In other words, education creates differences among us because it changes us, as Pastor Butler emphasized in his opening statement for Battle Creek College. And church education changes the church. It just does. The trick is to make them good changes and to take an interest in them, but there will be changes. And not only church, I mean, national education changes the nation, or lack of it, as the case might be. That's life. In short, when we introduce education into any community, including a church community, it is changed. That's why we speak of Pastor Butler and Figuer as brave church administrators. They introduced education, and thereby they introduced change without knowing exactly what that change would be. It was an act of faith, I think. As an example of this, consider the recent book by Adventist historian Gilbert Valentine on developments and changes in our church during the 1970s. Maybe you've read it. It's called Some Birds, Canaries and Ostriches. You wrote a review on that, I think. I think I read it. Anyway, it's an interesting sort of gossipy book, but has a lot of information in it. One issue that is opened up in that book had to do with the origin and authority of Ellen G. White's writings. Did she get her information only supernaturally in visions and dreams, or also more naturally from reading books and talking with people? That's what he writes about. Notably when preparing the Great Controversy and the health message material. That question evidently had come up in 1919 in a Bible conference and had troubled the church leaders, who knew at that time, 4 years after her death, something about the sources for Ellen White's writings. They knew it because they knew her and knew how she wrote. So that caused them to file the Bible conference notes away because it was troubling what they learned there. By the 1970s, when Valentine's book kicks in, all that had been forgotten until the notes were discovered. Same notes discovered in 1970s, and some church leaders were troubled once again over these long forgotten notes about the Ellen White books were written. So the question I had to myself is, when they discovered again what troubled them in 1919, why didn't they just file them away again? That'll take care of that. Deep in the walls, file them away. Why not? Because of a little problem. By that time, the church had acquired universities. You can't file things away from universities. They're like that. And they were charged. Universities are charged to seek information and answer questions. That's what we do. How did E.G. White write her books? Was the question. The answer came from university people saying, well, she also used written sources. At some point, church leaders accepted the inevitable, so it seems, and they checked the Desire of Ages and found the same pattern there, I'm told. I didn't do that myself. And currently, the findings of the sources behind the Jan Hus chapter in the Great Controversy are being published, I understand, with, I guess, approval of the White Estate. It's just more natural now to think of that that way. The good thing is that through all of this, the writings of E.G. White are still with us and are used widely in the church, which now knows exactly how they were produced, but they're still used, which tells you something different about the writings of E.G. White and their value. It's even possible, I think, that these discoveries in university libraries and the faculty offices will end up actually benefiting the church and its members who live in an information age in which the provenance, the origin of any idea or even a word can be traced and identified on an iPad or handheld telephone. You can't file things away now. Is it not better for the church to get out in front of such matters, thanks to the investigation of historical sources carried out by the universities? I rather think so. And the fact that this is now being talked about more freely would suggest that that is exactly right. You get out in front of it, and then it is not so troubling. You can deal with it. It's like raising children. You know, when they're teenagers, you don't know too much about what they do, and sometimes you wonder if you should know or not too much. But getting out in front of it is probably the best way to deal with it. From this, I conclude that the Christian university and the Christian church belong together in a shared mission much, much more than we realize. It is regrettable that it has taken so long for both sides to realize the importance of what is in actuality a partnership. Too many angry and judgmental things have been said and written prematurely. In moments of frustration, I understand that, positions have been lost and reputations ruined, and the church estate office, White Estate Office, and the university have both been held up for ridicule, for questioning what the other side is putting on the table instead of studying it. The white lie and the white truth were two books that I should never have been written. It is a little offensive to me and embarrassing to play on the word of Sister White that way, write these books about it. They're not helpful. This kind of stuff is not helpful. But at the time, we were all hot under the collar, so we wrote them. What we ended up doing is finding out how to read things is much, much better. Critical comments and uncharitable attitudes do not always get sorted out before being spoken, even among fellow believers. The church and university ought to make common cause once again in their shared vision, is my preference. Something else. The university has become international thanks to the church. I don't know if you've thought about that. We owe a lot. The church had from the beginning committed to an international mission. For example, Andrews would be only a shadow of itself without the worldwide church, many of whose members hungered for education following their conversion. And the church responded by sending Andrews to them. It's amazing, but that's what they did. And I'm old enough to have met these people. They came Andrews, and they said, oh, okay, we can deal with that, and we can get a degree, and then we have to go to Michigan, and if you come from Africa, it's a bit cold over there, but we would rather have a degree and get cold than stay warm and not get it. So they got Andrews degrees. And just yesterday, I was having lunch in a cafe with some people, and here was one graduate student, I think. And he gave me a card. It was yellow and brown from his billfold, and it was a certificate that he had a degree from Andrews earned somewhere in some distant country in Africa, and showed me that my signature was at the bottom. It was an affiliated degree, and this was his card, that I'm a graduate, and I was hungry for education, and they sent me Andrews, and look what I have. I said, keep it safe. So the church responded by sending Andrews to them, and I'm proud of that. It's a huge thing. The church has promoted its understanding of, have commitment to personal and community health since receiving its first health message in 1863. Nowadays, that message has been greatly expanded and is delivered with strong support from the university through its research laboratories and studies in epidemiology. And what would we do with our health message if we only had what we knew in 1863? And people would laugh us off the street. But now we know that this is bad for you and this is good for you, and here's the evidence. So the collaboration between church and university has been tremendous. Under pressure from the university's understanding of the inevitability of social change and gender equality in the world, the church is now accepting gender equality and women in ministry more and more, most places, so it seems. And where did that pressure come from? From the university. I mean, this is what, that is, we read the stuff and then you say, wait a minute, you should think about that. It's coming like a locomotive down the track. Get ready. Get in front of it. Science and religion have developed strong partnerships within the church in the field of medicine and related disciplines. Our seven medical schools, I think there are seven, around the world, are strongly supported by the church, financially and in every other way. I just heard about the newest one in Africa. It's amazing what they're doing, raising huge sums of money for that university. We have not resolved the conflicting and contentious views of origins. That will continue to call for conversations. Our church retains a more geocentric view of origins, while science in general is moving to a more cosmic-centric view. Both views are constantly being bombarded with new information, as in a recent space telescope, or the genome sequence, or climate change. And then did you read recently? A whole new line of dinosaur footprints discovered at the bottom of a lake in California that dried out because of climate change. And now we have to deal with these dinosaurs wandering around there. Where do they fit in to our models? So it's a never-ending conversation and struggle to try to sort that out. And that's not done, I would agree. Finally, as in the Protestant Reformation, so in the church, the impetus from the university helped move most of the churches back to the New Testament teaching of grace and righteousness by faith. This has kept our church family firmly within historical Christianity, of this away from sectarianism. Among the strongest spokesperson of this biblical understanding of the atonement are many, many university-educated people, starting with Martin Luther, who lectured on the book of Psalms, and he said, by Charles, the church is wrong. It's by grace, hallelujah, out of a university lecture hall. We forget that, and we should have discoveries like that coming out of our lecture halls, I think. And don't forget, the Sabbath teaching has benefited from university spokespersons, and the first serious book on this subject in our church comes from the namesake of Andrews, namely John Nevins Andrews, who wrote the first full-size book on that topic. And he did it from the library at the University of Rochester. That's where he lived at the time. From all this, I conclude that in general and over time, the partnership between church and university has led to better understanding of our faith and has strengthened it. Even the failure so far to reach this objective in some areas does not obviate the importance of this partnership. In fact, it calls for its increase. And that's all I know. In fact, a bit more than I know. So that's the end of my comments. Thank you for your patience.
Thank you, Dr. Andreasen. If it was your intention to give us a boring lecture, you failed miserably. I detected a little bit of juiciness throughout the lecture.
Okay, you want to squeeze the...
But it was a loyal, we'll call it a loyal juiciness.
Of course, yeah. That's what we are, aren't we?
Yeah. We have quite a group on Zoom that have joined us, and if we're going into our question and answer session, so don't run anywhere.
Oh, I was trying to escape.
Those who are giving us questions, send them to Dr. Kathy Cadell, and she will read them. She'll let me know when some questions come in. I can't guarantee that the questions won't be juicy.
Oh.
So if, as we have done it in the past, if you have questions, comments, put up your hand. Two mics will be floating around. Okay, and I'm going to go where it's closest, and we'll start with you.
I really appreciate your talk, and your insights, I think, are very profound. I guess one of my observations or concerns is it seems that in many ways the church is more divided in its spectrum of belief, support, and membership. On Adventist Today or Spectrum, Elder Wilson's called Taliban Ted. On the other end, recently a conservative pastor basically called him a follower of the Antichrist. So, I mean, to have that in one community of belief, Taliban Ted or a follower of the papacy, is a very complex thing that I'm not sure how a university solves. The COVID thing has separated us somewhat. Not only gender issues, but LGBTQ+ community issues. So it seems that the issues we face today are maybe greater than we have in the past along the issues of science, gender, sexual orientation. What can the university contribute to that divide?
Well, it's a good question. And maybe that's what I should have tried to talk about, but I don't know what to say about all that stuff. But I would only say this, that my experiences in my work, not dealing with this issue, but my experience in the work is that when you have a lot of stuff going on, there are sort of two ways you can approach that. You can get into the weeds and try to pull them all or sort it all out, what to do with all that stuff. Or you can get above it or out in front of it a little bit. And I have found that to solve even detailed and difficult, clearly defined, difficult questions like that, one starts from a view about where should we be? What is it we are aspiring to achieve? And I'm actually more interested in that because the other start at the bottom can sometimes just drive us in many directions. And I also don't want to drag present personalities into this conversation. This is not, to me, the Christian way. It's the ideas we deal with. So I don't want to make comments about this person and that person and so on. I like to think the best of people. But what matters to me is to set up an ideal. And whether that is the church or whether that was Andrews University, it's like the lighthouse. This is where we should hurt the cattle, so to speak. That's where we should aim. And if you do that deliberately, it's amazing how often solutions present themselves, not to everything, but one here and one there. So I thought, when I spoke, fancy that decades-long discussion and debate we had in our church about the healthcare message. That was the wrong numbers. I mean, he was here, I think, teaching at one time, or maybe not, but in Loma Linda. No, he was in Loma Linda, yes. And we had all this stuff. And he was supposed to come here and speak to Forum, and I got telephone calls. Unbelievable at that time. So that was not good. But then I said to myself, just a minute, what was that about? Was that about our health message, or was that some kind of a, in the archives, argument? Meanwhile, the country is suffering from bad health. And now I told you about the problem with children in school. They don't learn, they have mental health. It's a national epidemic. And my son is involved in trying to solve that in Portland. But that's where the health message needs to be at work, I think, at these levels. And the university is much more helpful in a way than the church. But I think I wish the church would come in and say, okay, we have 10 churches in the Portland area, and we're going to use all of these as well as contact points between parents and their kids in school to see if we can help as well. Then we might achieve something. So, yes, there are these endless problems. But you know, I found 5 areas where we had worked together and made some progress, including righteousness by faith. I mean, how many decades did that take before somebody finally said, right, on that point, Ford was right. It is by grace. That's the only way. Martin Luther said it, and I guess Ellen White said it, and everyone else is saying it now, except when we forget to say it. So that's clear. We work together on that. The health, I think, we work together on. And the other thing, internationalism. This university has always been more international than any other university in the country. And I ask myself, why? Answer, church. We could go anywhere to any country. And there was an Adventist with educational ambitions, and we connected right away and knew what to do about it. So there's a lot of examples of things where this works. And I would say to the people who still haven't, who are still like that, back off and figure out how we can be a blessing instead of the other opportunity. And I think, quite frankly, it's not only in managing this issue between church and university, it's also managing the university's issue. You have to drive the institution forward over the top of all the muck and establish out in front where it is we want to end up. And on this Portland story I told you, since it's our son, we're a bit proud of him, you understand, can't help that, we're parents. He walked the campus and said, that's terrible. Lutherans lost their school. What are we going to do about it? Well, what needs to be done? All the kids in Portland. Okay, how can we help the kids in Portland? Well, we establish a campus that deals with school education, mental health for students, and we train them by university, and we ask Microsoft to fund it to the tune of $420 million, and they gave the money. Because it was a solution, not an added problem about, oh, you know, the explanation why the kids are behaving that way is this and it's that, it's your other economy, race and all of that kind of stuff. And the other people saying, no, no, no. How do we fix it? And what does it take to fix it? To get parents and the kids and the teachers together with professional experts to drive it forward, something like that. I'm sorry, Gary.
So I appreciate your comments on research. And Duane can tell you much more about the mutual benefit of our doing research for the worldwide church. It's a benefit to them and it's a benefit to us. But I have another question for you. Several years ago, you actually made a comment to me that university academics and church leadership speak different languages. And it was your responsibility to translate between the two. You probably forgot that, but you did say that. My question is, what can we do to better speak each other's languages so that the university academics and church administrators can speak the same language, or do we always have to rely on a translator?
Yes. And before we beat ourselves too hard, this problem of getting large population groups to appreciate the rather specialized stuff we do is not a particularly a church group. I mean, the problem higher education suffers from in America is that too many Americans don't believe in it. And that's why I started out by saying, think of the American research university developed in the 20th century, the model of the rest of the world and what it has done. And in spite of that, how many millions of Americans would say, close all the universities and give the money to the poor or something? This would be the worst possible thing we could do as a country, as a society. So I would begin by saying this is a common human problem, and it probably takes academics acting like evangelists. I mean, it's my job in a way, or was my job when I worked here. I need to tell people who's saying, the poo, 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 what do you do at Andrews? Just a bunch of eggheads. No, it's not. Let me tell you, we did this, and we figured out why people are addicted to this and that. But did you know that? And this is how to fix it. And just hammer away at it and have a convert here and there. It's just like evangelism for an educational course, not a faith course. So I don't know if there's a trick to it, except just persistent. And sometimes I have been accused correctly of sounding a bit arrogant about these matters, and that's my mistake. We should be pretty humble about it. I mean, we are privileged people sitting in our offices working 10 hours a week with our students and thinking ideas for the rest of the time. It is a privilege to be an academic person in many, many ways. And I thought about it often when I got my first job. Fancy that. That was at PUC when I began teaching. I had 12 classes in those days. We were poor, teach many classes, 12 classes a week. Well, that's a day and a half's worth of work, 8 hours plus 4 hours. What about the rest of the time? Well, I had to prepare a bit and do this and that, but I had a lot of freedom, and I considered myself to be fortunate. And I will still say, yes, you may think we are a waste of resources. We consider ourselves fortunate, and that's what we do in response to it. So a lot of preaching, Gary. Just get on your soapbox and tell everybody. Now that Lily has funded, and that has to do with inner city ministry, well, that's the Portland stuff all over again, how to take care of the kids. And you'll say, well, we're doing that. And cranking out how many? 10, 20 people a year with these qualifications to serve in inner cities. And this is the improvement of society they will make. And it will be sponsored by the church, so the church will benefit by getting appreciation for that. Something like that, I think.
It appears, if I'm reading you correctly, that there may be more of a parallel between the medical work that separated itself from church administration to a degree in generations past and the educational system now. If that's the case, is it going to be more difficult for the educational system to effectively communicate with General Conference administration?
I don't know how to answer that question fairly without thinking a lot about it. It may seem, what did somebody say? The medical work is the right hand, and he said the right elbow too of the message, and they kind of push a little bit. But I don't think I completely agree with that. I mean, there's been lots of tensions between the medical work and the church over salaries years ago. That was when Neil Wilson was president and they had to do something with that. When we changed the wage scale to a university scale or something, and I said it's not disloyalty to the church, it's just the kind of people we need to hire and employ at Andrews University. And they are not pastors. They have different qualifications, and we need to work with them in a different way. And so eventually they understood that. And I think the argument on the employment side with the medical people is somewhat similar to that. It just came earlier. But then, of course, there may be other areas you have in mind, medical church versus education church. I don't know. I'll need to think a little bit about it to get closer to an answer on that one. But thank you. Good question.
I think a lot about 2050 and what we will look like as a university in the year 2050 if Christ has not returned. Can you offer a couple possibilities and what will make the difference?
2050, how many years from that is now? 30? 28 or something like that? Well, let me tell you about that. The answer is I don't know what it'll be like in 2050. There are too many variables. However, one of the jobs I did in retirement, it's not much of a job, but I was in Africa talking to some educators about that question for their schools in different countries. And the general conference said, well, write it down. And I said, I don't know that I can do that. But then I called my son. I said, do you deal with questions like that? He said, not really, but a little bit. I said, okay, we're going to do it together. So we wrote a book about it. This is a small one. He wrote the second half, I wrote the first half, and we met in the middle pretty well. And that was the question, how do you project out, not just by asking what are all the external factors that will impact you, but also how do you respond to them, which is an institutional response. So in my frustration, I said, well, and my son has repeated that to university presidents all over the country. The academic administrators, the deans, the provost, finance people, all those, their job is to look at the university through a microscope, to find out what are the numbers, what are the trends, what's happening with this school and that school, and what are the credits, and what is coming down, all the details. But the president looks at the university through a telescope so as to see further. So this is a telescope question that you're asking. And I think in some ways right now, that's the most important question we can ask. So when university presidents asked me, what did you experience? I said, the trick is not to focus too much on now. Let the deans do that and sort it out. But think only about minimally 3 to 5 years out, preferably 5 to 10 years out, and steer by that. That's really difficult. That's why the search process at Andrews is really important. And we can all help the president to do that. But you always ask, not this year, 5 years out. So our son had a boss who was fussing about something in the budget. And Michael said, my father said, get off the microscope, put the telescope up, and ask yourself, where should we be in 2030? We can look that far. And maybe we can put together some plans, some designs, some responses to external pressure that enables us to begin to project that. That's what I would do. And I remember, that was slightly embarrassing, when I first became president of Andrews, there was a meeting of presidents somewhere, I don't remember where it was in the country. We were all sitting around the table. It was in the fall. And somebody went around and said to each of them, how's your enrollment? How was the budget for the enrollment? Are you ahead or are you behind? What percentage increase and how many students is that? They asked that. And I was new, I didn't know that that would be asked. So when they came to me, I said, I think we are ahead, but I don't actually know the exact numbers. I didn't pick that up on the way here. And I felt really awkward about it. And an outside person, a consultant or somebody said, well, don't blame him for that. That's not his job to figure that out. The dean ought to know that. Call him up and ask. This guy, the president, ought to figure out what the enrollment will be in 2015 at that time, you know, in the future. So I learned by embarrassment to throw my thoughts out. And I remember when I was here, I finished some job, I don't remember what it was, some project, some stuff. And I walked across campus with a couple of people, and I think one of them may have been, no, maybe the provost or the finance person. And I said, I'm 70 years old. I don't have that many more years. Let's suppose I had 5, if the board re-elects me. Suppose I have 5. What damage could we do in the next 5 years? Not what can we do next year, but if you imagine what we could do in 5 years, what would that be? And so he said to me, fix the old gymnasium. I said, fix the old gymnasium? That's not a worthy goal. Make a new one. This is a cold place. Students come from the south now, keep them inside and warm and nice in the wintertime. And so we got that idea. Is that a good idea or not? I don't know. But at that time, it was projecting out where we thought students would be, where we thought the community would be, where we thought we could connect with people who should be connected to the university. And so we said, all right, that's it. 5 years, let's see if we can do it. And so when I retired, I'm personal now, but this is a personal question. When I retired, someone said to me, do you have to do that? I said, yeah, 75. Doctor says after 75, all bets are off your health. I said, okay. That was Hamill, you know, Lowell was my doctor. Said, you're good for the next 5 years, but after that, all bets are off. So I said, yes, I have to retire. And don't ask me to stay for one more year, because this university or any university doesn't need a one-year president. You need at least a 5 to 10 year president to address that question. So that's what I would look for. And I don't know now what the answer is, but I think that probably in one afternoon of thinking, looking at all the stats and demographic changes and this and that, you will see about 5 ideas that present themselves. So hone them and fine-tune them, and one will say, that's what we're going to do. Will we be right? I don't know. We are never completely right when we project ourselves out. But if we don't project ourselves out, we are wrong. So, sorry, but that was a good question.
Thank you, Dr. Andreessen. Appreciate it, and we'll try to get you back sometime.
I'm not sure about that. You may not want that.
Okay. Remember his age.
All bets are off after 75. Enjoy the rest of your day. Thanks for coming.